Okay, good morning, everyone. This is Henry Harris, and it is Thursday, December 6th. And I welcome you to another installment of the weekly Emunatella conference. I am going to begin, as usual, with a recap of what this call is about, and then I'm going to look at some beautiful questions that were brought to my attention in the last week, and I'm going to do my best to answer them. So the way I'm looking at this call at the moment, although it's not really changing, it's just kind of the way I'm so sorry for my congestion and my difficulty speaking. I'm going to do my best. Is that we're here to understand the nature of the truth behind our psychological experience, the truth about the way this world is being run moment to moment to moment by the Almighty, and simultaneously the illusion that is, of course, also made available moment to moment to moment by the Almighty, and the truth about that illusion. And I view those twin clarities as the mitzvahs of Emunah, and lo yelecho elohim acherim, not to have other gods, i.e. idolatry. So in other words, the clarity that there is only one source that is continuously powering everything. There's no power, there's no cause, there's nothing other than the power of the Almighty energizing and sustaining all of life. And for our purposes, again, it's a conversation about our psychological experience. My moment-to-moment experience of life, as much as I'm interacting with all kinds of circumstances and people and having memories from the past, my experience of life is being created in this moment by the gift of divine thought, the way the Almighty is allowing the form of this world to become fashioned. His infinite formless energy is showing up in the form of this world, and I have the opportunity to experience the gift of divine thought within my own consciousness. So that's where my experience of life is coming from. It's coming from him, and to the extent that I know that, it's a tremendous accomplishment to know that that is the cause of my experience in this moment. And then the illusion, the idolatry illusion, the notion that there is some alternative source that is worthy of attention, of response, reaction, etc. The notion that traffic is sourcing my anxious feelings, memories from my past events are the source of my insecure feelings, the notion that the disagreement I'm having with a loved one is causing all of those alternatives to this truth of the reality of one source, one creator in this moment, that would be the illusion of idolatry. And those are the twin pillars upon which what I'm looking to focus our attention. Now, what's fascinating is that I would say that the main outcome, the main beautiful intended consequence of those two clarities is a tremendous elevated understanding, a tremendous elevated state of consciousness with which it's amazing how much we can really enjoy and accomplish in this world. I last week referred to that as das, as an inner knowing. Really, that's why we're here. We're here in this world to arrive at an inner knowing of the truth of the Creator. It's not a knowing that is a kind of an intelligence knowing. It's not an ability to solve a math problem knowing. It's an inward knowing that we experience, but it's not a personal intelligence faculty that allows us that knowing. It belongs to a spiritual consciousness that resides within us, but it's not personal to us. And here's how I'm viewing it. It's so profound, it's so simple, and that is that there is no one in any place and in any time and any part of their lives that has experienced tremendous well-being and accomplishment, whatever it might have been, whatever area was in their lives, whether it was in their relationships, whether it was in a performance, an athletic performance, whether it was in a musical or artistic performance, any tremendous experience of success where people felt this just heightened state of clarity, heightened state of capacity, it didn't come from a personal clarity. It didn't come from like a personal skill set. It came from a tuning into a being in the presence of this greater intelligence that operated through them. That's what I'm pointing to when I speak of Das. Das is the outcome. It's the natural outcome of a person who walks with these twin clarities. And the way I see it is that these twin clarities are the great detanglers of our lives, the great unentanglers, all the ways in which we become entangled in the illusion of a world of multiplicity, of all these powers, of all these forces, of all these distinct entities. I become so entangled in which my feelings of worry and insecurity and anger and reactivity are all so logical inside the experience of entanglement, where all these independent, separate kind of forces seem compelling and meaningful to me. All of them, they're just so entangling, and I become wrapped up in this web in which I'm somewhat immobilized. I might feel myself able to thrash around, but functionally, I'm not exactly living a meaningful life. And as I live in these twin clarities, which again, as we've described, doesn't assume a certain emotional state. We can be in a variety of emotional states, but acknowledge the truth of these twin clarities, the truth of Emunah, the truth of the illusion of idolatry. Those truths are the great detanglers, unentanglers. And it's natural. It's like a person who wears, you know, who's wearing like a cork suit. Imagine a person had a form-fitting cork suit, and he was in water. He was like underwater.
Eileen Rose.
He's gone. Oh, welcome.
Thank you.
A person who is who's wearing a cork suit underwater, he's going to rise. Like he doesn't have to figure out how to swim his way up to the top. Now, if he pulls himself downward by grasping, you know, the weeds on the bottom of the floor of the sea, he can keep himself from rising upward. But his nature is that his cork suit is going to pull him upward. That's the metaphor that I'm referring to, that this clarity about the truth and the illusion of the real nature of what's causing our experience in this moment, what cannot be causing our experience in this moment, that's our way of letting go of all of the entanglements that keep us kind of in place. And when we do, our nature is to rise. Our clarity emerges. We navigate. It doesn't mean that we don't have choices, but the playing field becomes simpler. The playing field becomes much simpler, and that's truly the operating platform upon which we can operate there when we're walking with these clarities, this Emunah, and this clarity about the illusion of idolatry. So that's my intro. And now I want to touch on a couple of fascinating questions that were raised in various emails that I received this week. One of which was, if the premise of our conversation is that all experience, whether I feel intense anger or reactivity in the face of a child's action, or whether I feel equilibrium and calm, and let me think what's appropriate here. And I've experienced both. I mean, I've experienced just kind of like, you know, a total reactivity, like somebody shot me out of a cannon in response to a child's behavior. And in that same action I've had the experience of, you know, feeling like, what's going to be helpful here, you know, in a way that I was surprised. So if the nature of what allows for that experience, that calm or that tremendous surge of anger, if that's the truth of divine thought in this moment, and I'm not managing that, right? If that's what's coloring my experience, then first of all, where does that leave room for free will? Because it kind of suggests that I'm not, you know, that it's God that's programming my emotional states, right? If all emotions, if all feelings are an experience of a feeling of our thinking, we're having insecure thought, we're having more secure thought, and the Almighty is the one who's flowing that thought through me, then it would suggest that the Almighty is programming my emotional states. And if he's programming my emotional states, well, that's my, you know, a lot of my choices come from my emotional states. Is there room for free will in that model? And then number two, kind of related to this, is what about the idea of the acquisition of good character? Like, if everything comes down to what is the Almighty programming me in this moment? Like, how is divine thought showing up in this moment? It's not the traffic. It's not the misbehavior. It's not the loss of property that something, you know, a car getting hit, God forbid. It's not that alone. It's not that that is the actual cause. It's the nature of thought. Well, is there such a thing as acquiring good character? We certainly place a lot of emphasis on the development of character. And so how does that play in? So here's what I want to say to that. First of all, I just want to acknowledge that I don't view myself as an expert. I don't view myself as as the final authority in terms of what Torah has to say about these topics. I'm going to share with you what I've seen in Torah sources and how I understand it in the context of what I've seen in my own personal life. I want to say as follows. First of all, I've come to have a deeper respect for the mystery of free will. I can, on a philosophical level, it is the case that free will is a bit mysterious, because if it really is true what Judaism says, that ein od milvado, there is nothing other than the Creator. All there is Elokus. All there is godliness, and certainly our sages talk about this and the ability of us to comprehend this. If all there is God, then how does it work that I seem to occupy my own private kind of domain? You know, I've got my own address where I'm operating and decision making. It is a mystery of sorts, but yet we know the Torah tells us we have choice. Right, u'b'charta b'chaim, I've placed before you a choice between good and bad, and evil between good and bad, between life and death, and you shall choose life. We know we have the obligation. We have the possibility of free will. And personally, I have an experience of free will. I know from my own internal experience, an internal knowing of sorts, that I can sense the possibility of moving in a direction. In a multiple of directions. I shared recently at the conference how, you know, I was walking down the street the other day, and a memory arose of something I was bothered about, what my wife did or didn't do, and I remember standing kind of at the threshold of, like, you know, if I go back over those memories, I could probably get worked up and have a nice complaint toward her. You know, like, I could have a feeling, like a good, strong, hurt, grudging feeling toward her. And yet, simultaneously, I kind of sensed, but I also don't know if I really want to go there. Like, I'm in a nice feeling, and I don't know if that is something that is appropriate and true. And it was really like I could see and feel myself at the threshold of, like, could I walk into that, you know, into that room and revisit all those painful memories, but I don't need to. And it was amazing to me, the sense that I had of feeling and experiencing the possibility of that choice in that moment. So that's kind of where I can see at times for firsthand that I have a free will phenomenon. On the other hand, I will also personally testify to the fact that as I'm standing in an angry feeling, sometimes I don't even notice that I'm standing in an angry feeling. I'm just totally outside in and totally focused on changing the thing that is upsetting to me. It might be my child. It might be a customer service representative. I don't know. On the other hand, there are times where I find myself very angry. And I sense in a moment, there's a moment that shows up in which I'm faced with the possibility of, wait a second, what do I know about this feeling of anger? I don't know how to rid myself of it. I don't know how to alleviate the feeling of the burning anger. But I sense that there's something true that I know about this. And that is a choice, the choice to acknowledge what is true about this feeling and what's not true. I sense the presence of that choice at times. And that's profound. Now, it doesn't mean that I feel different in the moment. I might still have a hurt, angry feeling strongly pressing against me, but I sense the value of acknowledging the truth of that, which might or might not transform my feeling in the moment, but I nonetheless acknowledge there is a choice there. And then there are times where I wake up after the fact of a tremendous reaction, where my anger arises within me. I yell or I act in a hard or aggressive way towards someone. And I only notice the reality of that a day or an hour or a half hour later. And then I'm faced with looking at, okay, what happened there? Like, what was that? And I could dig into, well, he or she acted inappropriate, and that's why I did what I did. Or I can look and acknowledge something true. You know, what do I know about my role in, what do I know about what's true? So I guess what I'm getting at is that while I can testify to the truth that my experience moment to moment to moment is not coming from the outside, not coming from past events or anything other than the content of my thinking. If I think of a memory of a mistake I made in the past, there are times where my memory of that mistake feels neutral to me, and there are times where that memory of that mistake feels exceptionally unsettling and shameful. It's because the content of the information isn't so, that's not what we're talking about when we talk about divine thought. Divine thought is something that is below our radar. It's almost not noticeable to us except when it is. There are times where it becomes visible to us. But much of the time, the gift of divine thought is not visible to us. We can sense it after the fact. We can sense our mood. We can sense our feeling state, which is why, by the way, the sages say anyone who becomes angered, ki'ilu oved avodah zorah, it's likened to idolatry. The sages tell us, you know, your angry feeling are a good guidepost to a measure of the truth quality of your perception. That's, you know, what I'm pointing to is that the truth is my emotional experience of life, my psychological experience of life is being shaped moment to moment through the gift of thought. Now, my experience of free will is fascinating. It's a little bit mysterious. I know I have it. And as I'm looking at the truth of what the nature of this truth that we're talking about on these calls, my respect for, my appreciation for the fact of free will and the gift of free will deepens. You know, the sages talk about the idea that there is such a thing as a nekuda sabachira, a point of bechira. We possess a very small point of bechira. It's not a football field of choice. It's not like I can select the mood I'm in a given moment, but I can select something. I can have an awareness of what's true on some level in the moment that I'm standing in. That's what I want to say about free will. And I'll say one more thought about character traits and about how how I see this, you know, working together. of course, we're after developing good character. As I see it, the essence of all character development comes from this understanding. The capacity to grow and acquire new stages, new vistas of truth, certainly comes from understanding where thought comes from, and it comes from clarity about that, you know, disentangling from the illusion of this world as a cause, this world as a truth. To the extent that we overlook that, to the extent that we actually accept the illusion and invest in the entanglements of this world, of course we're going to lock ourselves down. We're going to inwardly believe that our experience of life is dependent on circumstances, and of course we don't have control over the circumstances, and we're going to be immobilized, right? But as we open to the truth of this kind of, you know, moment to moment portal of divine gifts showing up in our heart, then we work with our nature. You know, as we said, the cork suit that we have that is naturally moving upward. It's naturally drawn to the godliness and the truth, the simplicity of God in this world. That is how our character gets formed. And so I'm assuming everyone on this call has had the experience of noticing how things that looked and felt common, regularly unsettling or threatening over time can start to feel different. It doesn't mean that there's not still reversions and forgetfulness about it. There's a point where I arrive at, like, oh, I guess I'm no longer bothered by this quality or disagreeableness between my wife and I. And then I am. And then I get discouraged because I think, I thought I dealt with that already. You know, we are grateful for the new visions that we see. We're grateful for the clarity that we have. And ideally, we're graceful when we lose sight and we become, we revisit insecure thought and reactivity in a way that we don't notice the truth about insecurity and insecure thought. And our sages tell us that, you know, don't believe, don't rely on yourself until you leave this world. Like, there's never a point where you've made it, where you have a mida, you have a character trait, and that's it, it's yours. It's certainly normal that we progress, but we don't own it in the sense that it's kind of a permanent fixture. And yet, of course, we see the world starts to look and feel different, and we navigate things. And to me, this is these clarities, these twin clarities of Emunah and the illusion of idolatry are the central resources with which we develop reliable character. So that is... that is my intro, well, that's my spiel. I'm going to unmute everybody. It could get loud. If you have a comment or a question, please raise it. I love the back and forth. And if not, we'll keep going. So here we go.
I just wanted to say hi.
Hi.
It's
nice
Melissa.
To hear your voice.
I've
Is that you, Melissa?
I've been wanting to get on the call for a while. I finally had time this morning, and I really
am
very excited
nice
to be
to
on.
Hear your voice.
Yes.
Okay, good.
It was a very good introduction.
Thank you.
Very good spiel.
Anybody else?
I'm going to ask you, if nobody else wants to ask you, I just happened to have been on with a client before this call, and we got into a lot of this, so I'll ask you what we were talking about and just see what your thoughts are on it. So she
Please.
Has a lot of regret that if she didn't spend certain money on her kids and on this, she wouldn't be in debt. And she's but she's always been in debt. So when she finally got an inheritance, she ended up giving it to her kids, and she's like, what if I didn't do that, and I wouldn't be in debt? And I kind of spoke to her a lot about this concept of, like, we don't know if you would have been in debt. Like, if you're really meant to be in debt, it's not like you went and you bought a Ferrari. Like, you did responsible things with the money. It was just that you didn't expect this outcome. So she has so much regret and fear around the fact that she's not being responsible. And she actually does not make more than her expenses are, which a lot of us are in that position. And she's just very regretful and sad about it. And she's just got a lot of fear. Her husband isn't. Her husband's more like, this is what we did. Hashem will help us. We'll figure it out. Like she was more worried about the fact that they did. In other words, that they acquired it, and maybe they shouldn't have given the money to the kids, you know, her married kids. I felt like we're not going to understand free will enough to know if she didn't do it this way, if she would have had debt anyway, or if she did do it. Like, in other words, my whole position, which we were talking, which was not such an innate health discussion, but it was more of an emunah thing, was we have to believe that we're in the position we're in, we're going to be in. Now, the steps we took to get there, like, that's just the al-kiteva of it, but it's not really the, in other words, we can't think we wouldn't be here if we didn't do this. We have to sometimes think, if we didn't do it this way, so maybe it would be that way. Again, we're not saying that we're talking about people that are being responsible and are looking to do the right thing. I'm not talking about someone that's looking to do the wrong thing. That's a different conversation. But as far as, do you agree with that, or would you have a different take on that?
You know, I think that if I'm understanding the situation you're describing, you're saying that someone is now in a place of less financial security, and if they had made a choice differently in the past, they would have been in a better situation.
Exactly.
And now they feel regret, pangs of regret.
Right.
And I think that, you know, there's obviously a number of ways to go in terms of helping a person find relief in that situation. I think what occurs to me is to look back to what do we know about the nature of a feeling of regret or a feeling of pain of any kind in this moment. You know, now she's associating it with the past choice,
mm-hmm,
right?
Exactly. Yes.
But what do we know about that? We know that there is no reality about a past choice that has power in this moment to cause my feeling. There's only the
mm-hmm.
nature of the thought. There's only the reality of divine thought in this moment, right? It's and that's why, by the way, we have memories of the past that show up and fill us with feelings of shame or regret, and then there are times where they feel softer, you know. It's not the content of the past decisions or the thoughts we have about our past that themselves are are causative,
mm-hmm.
right? There is it's
yeah.
What she's overlooking is that there's something that happened in the past that she can't go back and fix. But that thing in the past is actually causing her present pain. Well, good luck, you know, because unless you get a time machine, right, you're going to be stuck in pain. But that's a misunderstanding.
Right.
Now, it doesn't change the fact that she's in pain in this moment, and she might or might not be able to hear this, you know, which is the truth of how this whole thing works. But everybody here on this call knows that you can stand in pain in this moment and feel that the pain is, you know, feel very drawn to associate that pain with a circumstance, a past choice, a child's decision, a child's, you know, et cetera. And yet you can know something about the truth of that. You can know the illusory quality of that conclusion. That's an entanglement. That would be an example of an entanglement that, of course, it just, you know, it paralyzes this beautiful internal simplicity that resides within us. And she has permission to feel her pain. She's going to be, all of us are going to help ourselves by by looking at the big, by being open to and being curious about the truth about that pain.
Perfect. Thank you.
Hi, can you hear me?
I can.
Oh, hi. I think I was muted earlier and I couldn't figure it out. I just had a quick question, you know, about the free will.
Yeah.
When you say that it's like a point and it's very limited, and especially when you gave the example of how you said, like, in some situations you see this choice, right? You see the fork in the road.
Yeah.
And then there are other instances where you don't. Like, I certainly experience that all the time, and I almost feel like I don't have a choice when I have free choice. It's almost like sometimes it feels, it's very frustrating because any of my successes I feel I don't own. Like, I don't own my successes because I have no idea how I did it, and I could never, like, at will replicate it. I couldn't say this is the technique and this is what I do. And then a lot of the times I either have absolutely zero visibility and I just act, and then I kind of wake up after it happened when I'm not happy with what I did. Or even worse, sometimes I have visibility, but I feel like I cannot just choose the right thing. I just can't. And it's almost like I do in spite of myself. Do you know what I mean?
I can totally relate to what you're talking about. That's another version of how it shows up for me. Like, do you really need to yell at this boy right now?
Yeah.
Is
and then
it really
going to
be helpful? Well, you know, I'm doing it, okay? So just stop your yabbering and I'm going to do it, you know? I see that it's unproductive and I'm going into it anyway.
Yeah.
I can totally relate.
But what does that really mean? Like, I feel very confused and honestly discouraged at this point because it just feels like there's no win for me ever. I mean, there is win, but it's almost like it's there's nothing I can do about it.
You're saying the fact that I don't have the ability in a given moment to choose the emotional and behavioral response I want is discouraging.
Behavioral. Emotional, I kind of understand that I have no say because emotions come from thought and thought doesn't come from me, so I have absolutely no control over what emotion I have. But society around me seems to have a very firm belief that I should be completely in control of my behavioral choices. And that's just killing me.
Well, you know, we do. I mean, we do have a responsibility to live up to a certain standard. But you know what?
Yeah.
It's like, you know, it's interesting. I shared with a number of folks on the call last week about the episode with one of my children, which was kind of in mid, you know, he got really angry at one of his siblings, and I basically said, okay, you need to step away. And he just flat out rebelled and was like, nothing, no, I'm not doing it. I'm not listening to you. I'm staying right here, which was, you know, a strong response. And, you know, what's interesting is that when I look at him, I'm grateful for this understanding. I see he literally does not know how to navigate his anger. Like, his anger shows up inside of him, and he has, not always, but there are moments where he just has no recourse, no visibility about how to navigate his anger. And I realize, you know what, I have a special opportunity and responsibility to be of help to him, that I can, on the one hand, have compassion for the pain of feeling lost, really lost, in anger, and yet at the same time a recognition that there's nothing missing from him. He has all the wisdom and simplicity inside of him now with which to find a new way. And I'm not going to overlook a standard that he is responsible to and capable of. But I'm going to do it with compassion. I'm not going to do it with incrimination and whipping, you know, like the one model of change is Pharaoh, you know, like the tyrant. Like, you shouldn't do this, and you know, Pharaoh, by the way, one of Pharaoh's qualities was that he presented himself as a god. And how did he present himself as a god? Because he never went to the bathroom in front of anybody, right? That's why God told Moshe to appear before Pharaoh in the morning at the Nile to give him the first, you know, commandment, to tell him about the first plague. So why did he do that? To confront him and to confront the falsehood of his, you know, the illusion of his being a god. Well, isn't it interesting that one of the ways Pharaoh developed
or inculcated in, I can't hear. Thank you. Sorry.
No problem. One of the ways that Pharaoh presented to himself the notion of his being God was that he didn't have a need to relieve himself. Right? There's something so deep about that. Like human beings, when we eat food, it'd be lovely to have only the nutrition enter our system and have nothing else. It seems that the design is that we have the nutrition and we also have the need to eliminate. There's no way to avoid having a toxic quality to our internal nature, and our job is to kind of, you know, process it and eliminate it. And Pharaoh's response was, no, there is no toxic quality. You just be God. You know, you're just a god kind of thing. That's us. You know, like when we have zero patience for our nature that is inclined toward both secure and insecure thought. You know, both peaceful, helpful thought as well as toxic thought. So it's almost like we are, you know, we go into denial of this component of ourselves. And that leads to a certain tyranny, like, don't ever make a mistake. Don't ever reside in insecure thought. It's terrible to reside. It's tyranny. It's Pharaoh. And somehow or another, it's humbling. That's what I'm seeing. You know, there's a deeply beautiful, humbling process to come to grips with this quality within ourselves. That against our will, we are, you know, we are flowing with insecure thought. It's not, it's human.
Wow, thank you so much.
You're welcome. That, you know, to me, that is really every one of us has an inner paro. The part of us that wants to somehow believe or pretend that we don't possess an inclination toward insecure thought. We're never, ever going to stop possessing or experiencing an inclination toward insecure thought. I shared on a prior call how I noticed myself in the midst of this, you know, harsh internal judgment about what I wasn't doing and accomplishing. And all of a sudden it occurred to me, wait a second, this is precisely the dialogue you were having 30 years ago, except that the content of what you were judging yourself about 30 years ago today, like, oh, you're not doing this, oh, you're not doing that, that conversation I was having 30 years ago, today, those things that I was judging myself for not doing, I would look upon them as, you know, yuck. Like, I'm so grateful I'm not doing those things, you know? So I've evolved. I've evolved. There's no question that I've evolved, except that the nature of self-judgment, the nature of this insecure thought filling my heart, that's never going to go away. So that's the humanity that we possess that draws us back to what does it do? The presence of that insecure thought draws us back. It draws me back to the clarity that this world is not it. You know, this world is not where my answers lie. I want to look inward. I want to look beyond the incompleteness of this world. There's something else I'd like to share. Oh, yeah, please, go ahead.
Oh, no, go ahead.
Okay. No, because I'm going to share like another Dvar Torah, and I'd rather stay in the conversation.
Oh, well, I was just going to say, really, is there... is there anything we can do about this very limited nature of choice or free will? Like, or is it just this is it? Like, it's very limited, and we basically get to exercise it only when sort of he decides that we can.
Look,
do you know what I'm saying?
You know, we stand in the we're standing in the gift of understanding that there's an opportunity for acceptance. The opportunity for acceptance of the limits of our power. There's something to me that can be quite liberating about that. You know, if I tell you to go out, you know, to my driveway and attempt to lift up my Toyota Sienna with your hands, you're going to look at me and you're going to say, look, I can't do that. And I say, but give it your best, you know, give it your sincere best. And you'd say, okay, if you were to take me seriously and you were to give it your sincere best and you were to go out and you would, you know, make a sincere effort to lift up the Toyota Sienna and you would fail, how would you feel? Right? So, Sonia, how would you feel if you were to give it your sincere best to lift up the Toyota Sienna and you would be unsuccessful?
I mean, if it really was a Toyota, I would be like, well, I didn't expect to be able to lift it, so I would feel fine.
Right. It's a real Toyota Sienna. It's a real Toyota Sienna.
Then I would not feel insecure. I would feel amused.
That's right. That's right. Because you would have an understanding that that's not within the it's not in your control. Now, if I were to say to you, but deep down, I want you to know it's possible, but, you know, you're going to have to work at it. You'll have to, you know, so maybe you would say, fine, I'll come back. You know, if you were convinced of the value of it, I'll come back. Maybe I'll get insight. Maybe, who knows? But there would be a peacefulness about it, that you would come and you would show up each day and lift it. Oh, not today. Okay, maybe tomorrow. You know, it's not really different, the nature of our capacity to create a state of mind, to create. And frankly, to me, free will navigation is part of a state of mind. Like when we describe the possibility of feeling a lot of anger and we can resist that anger resist the reaction associated with that anger, that is indicative of a state of mind. That's a state of mind that's somewhat more expansive than experiencing tremendous anger and having no wherewithal to resist the reaction, right? That's a state of mind as well. Those are just different states of mind. Those are just pointing to the truth of the divine thought that is showing up in our hearts in this moment. They're just different states of mind. So I don't know how to create a state of mind inside of me. I don't know how to flow, you know, a higher state or to cease flowing a lower state. They're just different states of mind. And as I come to see the truth of that, that is my choice. You know, that is my choice. The choice to acknowledge the truth is a tremendously valuable choice. There's a huge spiritual value to that. There's a tremendous humility to that. Now, guess what? It happens to also be the case that it's going to work well. It you know, there's a reason why the Talmud says that in the later stages of Jewish history, the prophet came and stood all the 613 commandments on 13 character traits. And then the later prophet came and said 13 is too many to focus on 6. And another one came and said 6 is too many, 3. And then 2, until Habakkuk, one of the last of the prophets, came and said, one focus, let's focus on one. We have to fulfill all the commandments, but let's focus on one core character. What is that? Sadik be'emunoso yichyeh. A righteous person experiences his life with emuna, with this deeper trust. His chiyus, his life force, shows up in the character, this understanding of emuna. Your life force will be present. You will become unentangled of all of the illusions that will paralyze us, that will paralyze the simplicity that's so beautiful and powerful inside of each of us. You will become unentangled, and your nature will present itself more and more, and you will see more and more. That is the effect of this learning experience, of this willingness to become interested in the truth, to value the truth, even when the truth includes acknowledging the absolute limitation of our power.
And when you say the truth, you mean like the truth of where, of really where everything is coming from, you know, where experience
right.
is coming from, what the reality really is like. That's the truth. And so waking up to that truth is almost like part of your free will. That is your free will. Like,
yeah,
recognizing
that is your
choice,
to acknowledge the truth of your, to acknowledge the truth of your limits. Is a choice.
Mm-hmm.
To acknowledge
mm-hmm.
that Hashem is sourcing mm-hmm. an angry feeling inside of you. He's sourcing a state of mind inside of you. Does that
mm-hmm.
mean that you have license to do whatever you want? No. I mean, you know, that's the kind of, you know, it's part of the journey too. And that's, you know, when I'm looking at my son, who I can look at and I can acknowledge, this guy literally has no vision. It's not visible to him at all how to
mm-hmm.
redirect his angry feelings. And I have compassion for him because it hurts. It's like, who likes to feel paralyzed with anger? Even as he is acting in the way he's acting, I know that that's not deep down what he wants. And I'm not going to react to his behaviors, because I'm not myself dependent on his behaviors. My inner state is not, you know, dependent on him. On the other hand, I'm not going to overlook that there is the possibility of a new way of seeing the world. That's how I'm going to conduct myself with him. That's how I'm going to conduct myself with myself, to the extent that I, you know, remember. I'm going to appreciate that the Almighty arouses within me. He's showing me a territory of unacquired, you know, it's almost like there's unacquired territory in my own internal world. He's showing me, you know, my tendency toward anger is like a, you know, it's like there's a whole vista that I haven't yet been able to see, but it's there. And he's the one who has created that vista, but he's tasked me with you can see something about that. Not because you have the power on your own, but because of your, through a journey of being loyal to the truth, you will, that's your marker. You know, that's your you know, we let him kind of define what we're capable of, rather than I can't do that, you know, that's just not in my plan. No, I can't do that, I reject that, and I thereby, you know, look to opt out of the circumstance. You know, there are certain circumstances that we can't opt out of, and that means that the Almighty is telling us there's a new way of seeing and being in this circumstance. You can discover that.
Thank you.
you know, and this is, I guess, just to come back to, you know, the beauty of Hanukkah, the light of Hanukkah is really the light that this same, you know, this simplicity that I keep referring to, that Torah tells us we possess, this this wisdom that resides within us that is not, it's really about becoming disentangled with all the personal thought, you know, or how much we care about our personal thinking, how much we care about our calculations. That is what obscures that light, you know. And the beauty of Hanukkah is kind of revisiting the lack of calculations that the Jews made in those days. You know, the illogical quality. Like Greece was a culture of that valued knowledge, but the knowledge was a knowledge that was totally man-centered. It was totally, what is the world according to man? You know, what is the ideal society according to man? What is beauty according to man? What is good according to man? That was what they brought to the world. And yet the Torah views that, all that wisdom, as darkness. The Western world views the Greeks as, you know, the cradle of civilization. We view it as darkness because we're just, you know, we all hear, I've experienced, you know, what is my life according to me? I've gone there, you know, I've gone there plenty. And the more I dug into what is my life according to me, the more I ran into walls. And I still do it. You know, what is my life according to me? What is my marriage according to me? What is my child according to me? The more I prefer and value my calculations, it obscures the light that is present within me. And that's what we're navigating. You know, and the emotional state that we find ourselves, our mood, is a helpful resource. You know, we can look toward that. What do I know about this mood I'm in? Well, it looks like it's because of the past mistake I made. It looks like because of the way my child is behaving. Okay, that is a possibility. So, yeah. I don't know if I have anything else to add, but I don't know if anybody else has something to add. I'm willing and interested to kind of hear if there's anybody with a thought or comment in our last minutes.
Well, I wanted to mention one thing. I just remembered this past Shabbos, I had an experience that I thought, oh, wow, this is like what we're talking about all the time, but it was really unbelievable because I was having a terrible, terrible, terrible morning on Shabbos, and it was just like it couldn't get any worse, and I couldn't even explain why. It was really just horrible, and it was quite funny. One of my kids wanted everyone to go to shul. The other kid wanted to stay home and play, and the third one wanted to get some ice cream, and there was no ice cream left. And they were all screaming at the same time, like tugging me in different directions. And I felt like this is going to be the most horrible day ever, because no matter what I do, I'm going to lose, because somebody's going to be unhappy no matter what I do. And it's funny, I went into the bathroom. I literally escaped from them. Like I ran from them and I locked myself in. And I was just sitting there thinking how horrible and how doomed I am. Because it's just the morning, and no matter what I do, somebody's going to be super unhappy, and I am already so unhappy, and it's just like there is no good way out of this situation. And I literally sat there brooding like this, and then literally, and in the meantime, my husband was quite patient with me. He was like, okay, are we going? Are we not going? What are you doing? And I didn't say anything to him at all, and he said, what did I do? And I said, it's nothing to do with you. Trust me, it's nothing to do with you. And literally in a few minutes, I had a thought, oh, I'm fine and we can all go to shul. Out of the blue, like all of that storm, it was like a tsunami storm of horrible feeling. And I know that all feelings come and feelings go, but I used to think it has to take time, you know? Maybe next day I'll feel better, you know? It literally took 10 seconds. 10 seconds, and it was like, oh, I'm completely fine. Nothing is relevant anymore, and we're going to show. And I think my husband was a bit surprised, like, why were you hiding in the bathroom? But and then we went to shul and we proceeded to have a great day. And I just, I don't know, I was really struck by that. Like, I don't think I've ever noticed that before happened to me. You know?
It's beautiful. And, you know, I think we'd all can, you know, can appreciate that that's a lovely outcome. Now, obviously, we also know that that might not show up, right? That settling down and insight experience, right?
Absolutely. Most of the time, it doesn't.
Yeah, you know, and like I always like to refer back to the metaphor of birth. Like, you know, when a woman is giving birth, she just doesn't know how long it takes. She doesn't know how long the contractions last. She doesn't know how long an individual contraction is going to last. She doesn't know how long the process of contractions is going to take. She doesn't know. And it's like, let's say she has a child after, you know, one time the process is an hour's worth of labor and another time it's 22 hours worth of labor. Does her appreciation of the beauty of birth and the meaningfulness of birth, is it different? Like, is it, you know, I'm not saying one is less painful, one's more painful, but the pain is not necessarily suffering when you understand the truth of it. I don't know how to avoid pain. I don't. But there is something called suffering that I see is that comes from misunderstanding. You know, we're here to gain respect for this understanding, for the truth of how pain works, how our experience of feeling lost works. And that has the possibility of, you know, that respect for how truth, for how experience works is where we're looking. Thank you so much. I love your examples. I love your sharing, and I love the questions. I want to reiterate my request that experiences of seeing things or questions that you have, I really look forward to both. You can reach me at info@JewishCenterForWellbeing.com. You could leave a message at 845-393-1529. And I want to wish everybody a beautiful, beautiful Hanukkah, touching that beautiful, simple light within each of us and within the entirety of the people of Israel and in the whole world. And I look forward, God willing, next Thursday to doing it again. Have a good week and a good Shabbat.